Everyone ready?
Sure.
All right. Hello, BattleTech fans. This is Travis from Renegade HPG, and we have one hell of an episode for you today. If you haven't caught my previous roundtable episodes, it's basically where I pulled together a handful of BattleTech creators to geek out together about anything we want for a couple hours. And today, I have an all-star lineup featuring Tex of the Black Pants Legion, Michael Stackpole, and Blaine Lee Pardoe. If you don't know who any of these folks are already, then I'm a little envious of you because you have a chance to experience some of the best content BattleTech has to offer for the very first time. And for the rest of you, I'm sure you're sharing my excitement about whatever craziness is about to follow. So with that, welcome, gentlemen. This is going to be fun. This has been, what, about 8 months in the making to try to get all of our schedules together. And so thank you for your patience and persistence as we did it. But I'm glad to be here and ready to geek out about some BattleTech for a couple hours. The first thing I had, one of the side projects that I've been doing for Renegade has been Gallery 3025. We're basically kind of bringing artists to kind of visualize our own cool scenes from BattleTech. And I thought it'd be cool to kind of launch that post to get a little attention for that side project, but also to kind of ask you guys if there has been any kind of scene, moments, visual that you've always had in your imagination for BattleTech that hasn't really either been realized at all or hasn't really been realized in the way that you would have liked it to have been. And since Mike, since you're kind of like the senior, the old guard here, I'll let you start with that because you've had more time to maybe fantasize about things that have not been able to come into fruition officially.
Sure. Yeah. Always start with the silverback. Rather curiously, I actually don't. One of the things that just always impressed me about BattleTech was the level and quality of art in all the projects. There may have been a cover here or there that were kind of clunky, or places where illustrations just didn't quite live up to what you would have hoped. But by and large, the art has just been stunning. I will mention there was a time when NAL had decided, Rockbooks had decided that they would have the authors art direct their own covers. So when we turned in books, we were supposed to tell them what we thought would be a great book cover. And I was the first one up in that list. And I've been in publishing long enough to know that this was the worst idea since rejecting Hitler's application to art school. Okay. This is just how bad an idea that is. And the reason for that is simply that book covers are an advertisement. They're meant to sell. And writers have no clue, really, what that's supposed to be. That's why publishers have art directors and they hire artists. So I specifically requested a cover that would have been a brilliant cover. It would have been fantastic. Would have been a great piece of art. Would have been the worst cover illustration known to man. And so with that request, they killed that program. Now, as it was, I got a really lousy cover for that book. It's mostly orange, looks awful. Yeah. I think it's Prince of Havoc. But Fred Saberhagen said that was one of the worst covers he'd ever seen. So I guess in this case, the question is, have I ever seen a piece of art I wanted unimagined?
Yeah.
And it would have been that one, at least less orange in it, if nothing else.
So that was what you requested, just poorly done? No, or that wasn't
was
what
not
you
not at all what I requested.
Okay, well then you got to tell us what you requested.
So that's the book where Vlad, it opens up with Vlad being trapped in a cockpit underground and he emerges out of that, and so I sort of visualized, you know, the mech's head surrounded by rubble and this guy just emerging triumphantly up through the faceplate, kind of like a Greek god being born out of the forehead of a titan, which, you know, again, if Frank Frazetta were painting that, that would have been excruciatingly perfect.
Yeah.
But of course, they were never going to give me Frank Frazetta. They just decided that was a totally budget-busting description of artwork, and so it was just never done.
Yeah, the budget has been a concern. I mean, Blaine, we'll let you go next because Tex, I'll have you go last because you actually get to direct a lot of art more than probably any of us, probably all of us combined. But
allegedly.
Okay. So, Blaine, what's yours? Do you have any there?
Well, you know, there was a period in the 90s when we were doing the FedCom Civil War stuff and some of the post-Klan invasion stuff where we got a lot of cover art of actual characters. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, it's been all mechs. And that's fine because it's BattleTech and people want to see the mechs. The one piece of art I have always wanted from a mech perspective is I wanted General Kerensky's Orion knocking open the gates to the palace. You know, just because it's an iconic scene, we all kind of mentally can picture it, but to see it visually done really well would be fun. This is going to sound funny in some respects. If I were to look for character stuff that I would like to see, I've always wanted that final conversation between Kerensky and Armaris where they went off and talked. Nobody knows what was said. And then there's a firing squad. I always wanted to, that image of the two of them talking face to face. I think that could be really kind of cool depending on who did it. From a character perspective, I think there's like six pieces of art of General Kerensky and that's it. And most of them don't even align with each other. So it'd be good to get a really good visual representation of that meeting, especially with Armaris. I just think that would be fun.
Awesome. I like that idea. I really, you know, anticipate a day in the future where we get more content from the Star League era. I know you guys got a lot on your plate. You got to flesh out the Ilkhan now, but I think there's a lot of people out there that would love to have some more Star League stories outside of a source book and put them in a novel. But yeah, that sounds what Tex, you're up, man.
All right. Well, I just have to say for the record, it's kind of weird because you have two guys who've functionally written like half of BattleTech, and then you've got me. So it's like it's like now batting Mike Piazza, now batting Ken Griffey Jr., now batting some kid's brother. You know, I mean, I'm just glad to play ball as well.
You're modest. Your work has brought a lot, and your work amazing things for charity lately, which is truly commendable.
Very proud of that. I mean, we raise I can't count. It's the end of a work day, man. Yeah. But no, we do a lot for charity.
And tens of thousands.
And we're very proud of it. I mean, the BattleTech community is phenomenal. But when it comes down to art, I do have the advantage in that I'm paying for it. So I can say like, hey, you should draw me something. And they can go, well, I don't feel like it. And I'll be like, okay, well, here's the contract. You know what I mean? So you can actually direct it. And you have to really cultivate a lot of talents. And I've been very blessed to have a lot of amazing people step up and deliver, not just say I'm interested, but actually go above and beyond and kind of get what you're getting at and have that same sort of drive and passion, because we all know artists, whether they be writers or voice people or actors, who just phone it in. They're like, what do I have to say? Where do I have to stand? You know, okay, look, it's a robot. And they don't give a fuck. They just don't care. They're disengaged from it. But when you find somebody who gets it, who grew up with it, who cares about it, who grew up reading the stories, who grew up reading about battle reports, who grew up playing the video games, and now they have a chance to breathe life into this amazing thing. Good God, howdy. Yeah, I'm going to fucking pay them. Yeah. That's the best opportunity in the world. I've got somebody who wants to do the job, who has respect for it. And that's everything. So when it comes down to art, I feel blessed in that respect. As far as stuff I want to see, I would love to see the moment Kerensky said no, but I would love to see it done up like a propaganda picture. You know what I mean? Like a poster that was printed out everywhere and slapped on walls. So you would see some ash-covered, shell-cratered wall that was all pockmarked, and there'd just be a no on there. Yeah. And that would be this just moment of like hope. God, that would be amazing. I'd love
it. Awesome. I love that idea. We got a future Gallery 30 Time Commission there. it seems like Eldon does amazing work kind of imagining those kind of poster type things. And there's one that's done a ton of like recruitment posters. I posted one up on like Twitter or Facebook maybe a month or two ago. It was like just a simple curator one. But yeah, which made me think that along the same lines, I'd love to see kind of more like recruitment posters.
Oh, Eldon's, know, Eldon's great. I threw in a great bonus for him for all the work he's done.
Yeah,
because we've got a lot more stuff coming. Including my own stupid little headcanon place in BattleTech.
Well, I got his recent Marauder shirt on right now. So
those are great.
I got all of his shirts that he's made.
He does great work. I sent him a bonus recently where I built him in 1911.
Nice.
You know, just because I was like, hey, here you go, and he's like, oh, cool, I'm an artist, not, but okay, nice. But no, I've got a phenomenal art team. And it's one of those things where I feel in this weird place where you realize you can imagine things and then make them because you have other people who care similarly you can work with. It's an incredible feeling. It's an incredible feeling.
Awesome. And so, you know, kind of going on next thing, you know, exploring a little bit of, I know Marvel has its kind of What If comic series, and I think they're actually making an animated one coming up, but I've always kind of wondered what the alternative timelines of BattleTech look like, you know. And so, you know, this is definitely a question for kind of Mike and Blaine of kind of, you know, maybe go back into one of those writer summits back in the day, and or even just your own kind of imagination or idea that got shot down. You know, what was, you know, kind of looking at kind of how BattleTech turned out, was there ever kind of a direction that someone tossed out that seemed really awesome, but just wasn't quite workable or something?
Curiously enough, at the summits, we never really had anything like that happen because the staff and whatever writers got brought in all seemed to be on the same page. You know, we were all, in addition to creating this stuff, we were all sort of steeped in the mythos.
Yeah.
We knew all the things that were there. You know, I think the only stuff that got shot down, which was sidebar thing. We used to have these summits every 3 years. We'd have a summit. We'd come out with a 5-year plan.
Yeah.
And in, at Gen Con generally from the, whatever Gen Cons were, we'd always have the summit before Gen Con or immediately thereafter. We would have a meeting with the developers, the people who were going to be doing the game product, going to be doing a lot of other stuff. And we would explain to them what we were going to be doing over the next year. And there would be times when a few of the developers would want to solve mysteries that had been in earlier source books. You know, little things that had been left there. And I remember having to say, no, we don't want to do that. And the reason we don't want to do that is this. The solution you're offering is a solution we all know is true. Okay. You know, we all have our ideas about the Minnesota tribe and the Wolverines. All right. If we give the players that, they don't need us anymore. We have to give them something that they haven't seen before.
Yeah.
And so that really became one of the driving forces that we had of, you know, let's look at the momentum of the universe and where do we bump it just to shift it a little bit or to push it in this direction and provide an experience that everybody's going to enjoy, but it's an experience they may not have anticipated.
Yeah.
And so that way we could keep things fresh and exciting and still deliver the same sort of BattleTech content that they've always wanted.
Gotcha. So that's Mike. Blaine, was there any idea that you had?
Mike's already summed it up. Every time I throw out the Wolverines, they say no.
Blaine, it's automatic with you at this point, though.
I know. I don't even have to say it anymore. The fans weekly bring it up, and I'm just like, I got nothing. There's always an opportunity with alternate timelines to do some stuff, but I don't ever envision us going down this path. It would have been the biggest one of all is if Kerensky hadn't gone. What if he had just said, I'm going to stay? To me, I always thought that if I were to do a one-off alternate timeline, that could be very interesting. Because I think events would have played out obviously dramatically different. And it really, you know, I think we could have had some good character exploration and stuff like that. But honestly, most of the ideas we have, to Mike's point, we get together, we collaborate, and it's all positive stuff. I mean, you know, there's times you feel a little beat up when you walk out of the room, but everybody does at some point or another. You know, and because you, what you're coming up with are better ideas. And I think the summits are great to go to. I think the fans in some respects would be very bored to watch some of what we do. I mean, we had an 8-hour discussion, and I'm not exaggerating this, on how the Fortress technology worked at the last summit, because we knew what we had written in fiction about, but we never thought about the actual mechanics of it. So we got into this in-depth technological discussion about a technology that doesn't exist. You know, which it's hilarious. And we sit there, but we talk about this like it's a real thing. I always think the hotel staff is a little creeped out when they're delivering stuff to us, because we're babbling about mythical crap.
Well, that's what these roundtables are for, Blaine, is for us to kind of go on a random tangent. I don't think we can do it for 8 hours, but, you know, we can put a good 2 hours in here.
But I want to say, to Blaine's point, when you get everybody together in one room, it goes on for 8 hours and does not seem like it's been 8 hours.
Yeah.
No. You know,
everybody's tossing ideas out.
Oh, yeah, it's, I imagine.
Very, you know, congenial, except when somebody's being beaten upon. By and large, it's very congenial, and everybody really appreciates everybody else's creativity. So you'll have someone say, maybe we could do this. And someone else says, oh, man, if we do that, then we add this and we do this. Mm-hmm. Holy mackerel. And then everybody's going, yeah, and then we do this. And it really, it's sort of like watching popcorn go, but with ideas.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, you've got a story just blossoming right there.
Awesome.
Yeah. I would say that that's very true. And you have to be just kind of open to listening to new ideas. And to Mike's point, I think this is one of the keys to the BattleTech fiction that we've seen, is you don't necessarily deliver what everyone's expecting. We take a look at that a little bit. And as we have these summits and kind of go, yeah, but everybody thinks that's going to happen, so let's not do that. And that's, you know, it's hard because at the same time, we're fans, but we have to be able to justify the things that happen. And I think people think there's a lot of, well, that was Blaine's idea. No, a lot of times I don't even remember whose idea some of this stuff is. We're all throwing ideas out. What the end result is, you're not writing a book by committee, but you're gathering good ideas from a group of peers and colleagues that you deeply respect.
Well, on that, you know, idea of gathering good ideas, Tex, what's kind of like, you know, your favorite kind of maybe pocket of the BattleTech universe, or obscure pocket, or something that you would like to see fleshed out, you know, in kind of a novel or source book?
I need to interject just for one moment. Mr. Stackpole, are you familiar with the term stackpoling and what that means?
Yes.
I heard this term as a very young man out of context. And that's that term, hearing, oh, God, you just stackpoled, as a very young man. That phrase brought me into BattleTech, because I wandered over to the table and wondered what in the actual fuck these guys were talking about. And he's like, oh, well, the fusion reactor went up. And I was like, fusion reactor? That's pretty fucking cool. Well, what? Why did it blow up? And they're like, well, because the Gauss rifle shot it. And I'm like, a Gauss rifle? What's that? And they're like, it's a rail gun. And I'm like, this game is awesome. This is way better than other stuff. So, you know, I just needed to say that. So, you know, so, when you see Tex Talks BattleTech, all the dominoes going all the way back, the phrase that introduced me to BattleTech is, oh shit, I just stack pulled, you know, just,
well, there we go.
All right.
Awesome.
As far as like a what if, like I love the idea of, I talked about it on my podcast, the Cameron restoration. You have the Tirpitz that disappeared with apparently the last of the Camerons on board, and you have like a really sloppy attempt at a restoration, kind of like the Yorkists did during the War of the Roses. So you have this like attempt of, no, here is the king. And, you know, all these different people trying to back different factions. And you have a really nice Cameron Civil War, like the War of the Roses. So you would have different people all waving a banner, but in reality just being going, these guys look dumb. I can take advantage of them. So it, you know, it plays out in typical fashion. The other what if I like is, what if the Clanners knew how logistics work? But, you know, thank God. Or Capellan's math.
Indeed. Well, what if planets took more than a company of mechs to conquer?
Oh, so my many God. Things to go yeah, after. Yeah, God. What if strategic bombing didn't do the job? Yeah, it's we bombed them. Then what happened? They're still down there. Fuck.
So what's, you know, kind of talking through your writing process, what's kind of the most difficult, maybe silliest, maybe most humorous kind of canon situation has just been kind of like, you know, a thorn in your side when you've been writing a story? You're like, man, I wish this doesn't happen. I wish I could ignore this. You know what?
You're going to have to go to the big boys for that. Cause yeah. I have only accidentally become canon. So
Mike and Blaine, anything that stands out, anything that you remember just, you know, kind of cruising along on a great story and all of a sudden kind of hitting the brakes because there's something that you got to write around that's just really awkward?
Hit it, Blaine.
You know, honestly, it's not so much a thing. It's we're in a shared universe. So characters are not necessarily, you know, they're not our characters. They're part of a pantheon of characters that are out there, and different authors handle them at different times. And it's sometimes very difficult when you're handed characters that have appeared in maybe 6 or 7 other novels, and you have to kind of guide that character through. And there's parts of that character's background that you have to address in some way, shape, or form, you know, because otherwise you're not being consistent or true to it. But at the same time, you're trying to juggle where you want to take that character. And that can be a little bit tricky. And it requires a lot of soul searching. And there's a lot of times phone calls that are made to various people going, okay, well, you wrote this in this book, you know, does this sound true to what I'm trying to do at this point? You know, and that was particularly true. I think I've experienced it a lot with Hour of the Wolf because, you know, these were some characters I had only handled up in the recent years. They were existing characters. And people have said, well, gee, this character comes across cardboard, or this character seems too dimensional. And it's like, well, but I'm trying to be honest to everything that's happened before, because if you take it off in a completely different direction, it breaks the universe and it shatters kind of that myth that this is all tied together. That's my take on it, Mike. I don't know. You probably got a different feel.
Well, no, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I mean, there are times when another author will have handled one of a character that I created and I've written a lot about, and they do it in a manner that I think is out of character. And, you know, coming back in and trying to essentially right the ship without trying to make that author look like an idiot, whether or not they are an idiot, you know, but you're trying not to, you know, not to do that. I mean, there's that. I think the most difficult thing, actually, and that goes all the way back to the Warrior books, because of the 30 light year limit for jump ships, was planning the Fed Sun's invasion of Lao space. I think it took me 3 days to figure out all of the waves and get them all written down. So yeah. I knew what they were. And then I called FASA up and said, by the way, this is how it works.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one of those places where literally, you know, you're just working on these novels and suddenly you're creating canon for the universe. And you're kind of hoping that they don't come back and say, well, no, we want this to go here and this to go here. And it's like, no, trust me, this has just got to be the way it goes.
Yeah.
Now,
when you're doing that, because a lot of people, you know, the more scientific nerdy will point out that space is 3D and not 2D. And, you know, when you're planning those jumps and when you're looking at that 2D maps, do you guys account for, you know, a 3D, you know, space, or do you just kind of narrative conceit be like, all right, we got to just imagine that this is on a flat plane more or less and 30 light years to that is 30 light years to that instead of like there and there, where not?
Yeah, that's kind of poetic license.
Yeah.
You know, my assumption is it's a 2D representation of 3D space. And instead of having the stars all piled on each other so we can't see what they actually are, yeah, they just spread them out. And so, you know, that's, you just work it that way.
Right.
You know, another difficulty that comes in at the same time, you're writing a novel which is linear, has got a linear timeline, but you've got characters spread all over this universe. I mean, hundreds of light years apart from each other. If you go through all the novels, it's kind of curious that the vastness of space, key events happen on different worlds on the same damn day.
Yeah.
Just so we can have them be, you know, make sense in a narrative sense to be thrilling and sort of split second rescues and things on that order. So that's a little bit harder to justify.
Well, there's definitely a tendency, and I think this is a credit to kind of the storytelling and the conciseness there of BattleTech feeling, the universe feeling smaller than it really is, you know, because there is an enormous scale, you know, to the Inner Sphere. And just for me as a player, and I get the impression just based on what other people post on Facebook and whatnot when they're talking about this, is that, you know, like you said, it's the tendencies to feel like things are more connected, where it's like, I mean, there's things happening on the, you know, even 60 light years away that sure, nobody's going to know about, you know, is that that's just happening completely independent of each other, which is interesting to me. But how you would handle that is, you know, that would be difficult. And it's also interesting. We talked about this on one of the other roundtable podcasts. I think Bruins has brought it up of just, you know, what is the life of a regular non-military, you know, non-clan, not elite class, Inner Sphere citizen look like? What is your guys' take on that? You know, is it just like, well, I guess we're Capellan today, I guess we're Lyran today, you know, have you thought about that? You know, kind of what is that day in the life like? You know, what can they expect, you know, from generation to generation or even within their own lifetimes?
I mean, several different times in different books, I've actually, you know, noted that for the vast majority of people, you know, if their planet gets taken, all it means is that the face on the coins are suddenly different.
Yeah.
But new flag.
Yeah. I mean, it really does not affect their, you know, their everyday life in an appreciable way.
Yeah. It's just where the exports are going, you know, for that planet.
Where the exports are going, you know, what the title is you have to address your superiors in. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, depending upon the nature of the government that takes over, and not culturally, but whoever's on the throne, their particular attitude, yeah, you know, things may be a little bit dicier than otherwise. But, you know, there's probably, you know, a whole criminal element that just thrives. It does not, you know, the black market and stuff are going to constantly go on. You know, it doesn't really matter who's in charge. So there's a lot of adaptation and things that that happen in that universe just to make life possible. And the games of interstellar lords, it really have no, very little bearing on their daily lives.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I would say Jason Schmetzer's latest book that came out a month or two ago, and Blood Will Tell, he talks about when Lao comes in and takes over planets, how, okay, we're going to have to re-educate everybody here as to the nature of the state, your role in the state, and things along those lines. I think he did a really good job of that, which is, you know, it's not an overnight thing. It's going to take some time, but you're going to have to change how you think and things like that. And, you know, the people kind of resist that, but, you know, in the end, they're kind of used to it at this point. We've had 3 or 4 centuries of war going on here, and I think they're kind of used to running up a new flag. I would imagine just about everybody's got a collection of them. You know, it's like, oh, which armband do I put on today? Oh, it's Steiner. Ah, let's go.
Now, Tex, your perspective certainly on the universe is different as a historian, you know, by profession, and, you know, essentially what you're doing is dramatic recounting of you know, documentaries, you know, of BattleTech. What, you know, are there any kind of events, stories that have kind of captured your attention, or maybe questions that, questions would emerge for that Mike or Blaine could help you out with, maybe any kind of past up or present? I know.
I find myself going down rabbit holes and mm-hmm. just dump trucking information onto the page, you know, just being like, this is all very useful, you know, just kind of like a hoarder going through a yard sale.
Yeah.
And then later on you start raking through it, because you're sitting there going, okay, maybe not all of this is relevant. And you know, you start getting into really weird stuff. And I like what I've been able to find so far. And I'm very hesitant to reach out too much, because I don't want someone else's opinion kind of shaping a thesis. I want to fight my own thesis by myself.
Yeah.
And so I've reached out to Blaine before on the clans, and he was like, yep, I wrote it. You're pretty much on the money. And then some people argued in the comments still saying, this is not accurate. And Blaine was like, I wrote it. Yeah, yes, it is. And I mainly look for really fun ways to investigate the universe and show people why people fight. I love to drop my knowledge of the military industrial complex and military logistics on, which I find very fun. And then I get to try stand-up comedy by writing BattleTech jokes that are funny to approximately 8 people. The latest one I've got is, how come Capellan pants have no pockets?
Okay.
Wow. Property is theft, comrade.
Nice. I think I've got a bunch of notes in my my iPhone notepad for stand-up comedy ideas. That's on a bucket list. Like, could go to a comedy club and just
Fun until you start talking and then you forget everything you said.
Yeah.
So unless you can make amusing noises, I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, you never know till you try, right? You got to get crucified once or twice with a bad idea before you get to the good ones.
Oh God, don't I know it.
Yeah. What, you know, for upcoming episodes, I know you've been focused on mechs lately. You know, is there another one that's going to be focused more on a?
Well, next is the Warhammer, which is going to be something I have to be careful on, because I'm like, the Warhammer. Okay, so now I have to talk about the Hammer Hands and all the other stuff that led into the Warhammer and then early Warhammer development. I've talked about that generation of mechs, its contemporaries, why the Warhammer's around. I have my thesis where I say the Warhammer is like the AK-47 of mechs. It's good enough. It can do almost everything reliably well. It is not really refined, and both high class and low class people like it. It does the job. It comes in a lot of different ways, and it looks great with a variety of paint jobs. It's the everyman's working man's heavy mech. And if you don't know what the fuck a Warhammer is, you're about to find out. Yeah. And so that's my kind of approach to it. I'm definitely also playing with a lot of fun themes, writing some music. It's very stupid and very happy to do so. Because last time around, we got to write sea shanties for BattleTech. So, bad ideas are where we take flight. But after that, we're going to talk about the Charger, or as I like to call it, the little mech, the big mech that couldn't. Or military industrial compromise.
Nice. I like
it. And then after that, I opened up polls. We've got people wanting to hear a big history. At the moment, it looks like the Succession Wars, which means I will have to write a 38-part thesis where I try to talk about as many things as possible.
Wait, all Succession Wars or just one in particular?
I'm going to do one and see if I have any hair left. And then we'll go from there. I can sum up the Succession Wars very shortly. Like, kindness is hard, nukes are cheap. And then it goes from there. And, oh, God, this is going to be a nightmare. But, hey, it's what they want, right?
Yeah. People love it. So here's one. I recently had a podcast with Joel Bisk, you know, about kind of his early days of kind of the creating the line art for a lot of the mechs, you know, and I had the idea of maybe if I can, you know, nail down Joel for a commission or one of the, you know, other kind of, you know, maybe Dana or something that produced a lot of that early line art. If there was a mech that feel like we just needed a redo, in terms of how it looks? You know, anyone want to throw up one that you feel like? Oh. And I know Blaine, you statted a lot of the early mechs, didn't you? Wasn't that one of your contributions?
Yeah, I started with the first tech readout 3025. Yeah.
Any line arts that you just saw and it's like, man, I wish I could hit the do-over button. Reimagined.
I like the fact that they're very unique and different. You know, as much as people pick on the urban mech, I like the look.
I love the Irby. It's big brother. I have a problem. The imp. It looks like Humpty Dumpty, like did some roids and a rail of blow, and he's here to fuck town up. Like it looks horrible. It looks like a mascot. It looks like like the Michelin Man is taking names, and the tune of the day is falling down. Like he's here to mess things up. And I look at it and I'm like, who would design a giant combat egg? You know? Yeah.
I kind of feel that way a little bit about the Annihilator. It just it's an interesting concept, but it looks like a giant sperm. It's got that weird bulb up at the top. I don't know.
I'm with you on the Annihilator. I honestly think that something that's that big, that's like a quad autocannon platform, should look like it was made by Caterpillar. Like it should have the giant mining cockpit front on it, you know, and like the cockpit should have like a coffee mug and it's just like, use only genuine Annihilator parts, and it's all like chromed out and shit.
Yeah,
comes with some Macho Man tassels for the elbows.
It bothers me it's so streamlined, and it's like there's nothing streamlined about it. It's, you know. But some mechs are perfect. I think the artwork is great. I think especially the new miniatures designs, what I've seen of the artwork and of the new miniatures, I think they've done a really good job of getting them better and in some cases a little more logical.
I think so. I think the newer shit looks really good. And the thing that's really like kind of messed up is since I have one foot in would be nice and presentation and entertainment, if Eldonius and I don't like shit, we just change it, you know. So like the original Mackie looks like one of those cardboard robot things that a kid might put together and be like, look dad, I'm a robot, and so we made it different. We also made it not have dick guns, you know, because we thought, yeah, it's probably not a good place to put that between the legs where the gyro is and everything else. And so then it got to when we were doing the Rifleman, we started kind of subtly resculpting things because I'm a gunsmith and a huge gun nut. I got Eldonius to add the vent rib from the Colt Python on the Rifleman too, mainly because I thought if it's upsold as an SLDF premium product and the Python was the premium Cadillac of handguns, that's how the military industrial complex would sell it. They'd say, oh no, these are no autocannons. These are luxury autocannons made by Browning, you know, or whatever. And they would all have like deep blue, you know, finish on it that would flake off in a month. But it's one of those things where when you look at that visceral touch to BattleTech, my objection to some of these mechs, especially when I get a chance to kind of help reimagine them, some of my artists, is I look at it and I go, how the fuck would I get in there to do maintenance? Like, there's no such thing as maintenance-free equipment. I mean, the hood was up on the space shuttle all the time. So even if the best design crap we have requires someone to turn bolts, even if the smartest design piece of equipment we've put in orbit requires a man to get down there with grease and a cult gun, I mean, we need something that isn't all smooth and organic looking, because, you know, some cars are really fun looking, like Ferraris, until you have to change spark plugs, and then they become very aggravating.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because the latest project through Gallery 3025 is a reimagining of Jeff Lobenstein's Archer Under Repairs, which is one of my favorite kind of early arts. You know, just all the panels are off, that. Everything is there.
Yeah, that was great.
Pulled in Jaden Morris to kind of do that, and he has the outline. You know, we haven't kind of dove into actually pulling panels off, but we spent a lot of time, you know, as you said, you know, when you're commissioning the art, you can kind of redesign or tweak it out. And so we kind of like, you know, did a combination of kind of the new Archer with the classic Macross
well,
Spartan. And
I, I saw that, and I kind of liked the blending of it, but I also liked how you guys envision the field repair guys moving stuff in and everything else. And it's not just like a magic, yes, the missiles are back in it, but you have some guy named Frank who has to come up with like a cherry picker. Yeah. And he's like, all right, here's your thermos. Take 30 minutes, you know, and he's got a cigar and overalls and shit.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that, because that was part of the kind of the back and the forth, you know, that I had with Jade, and Jane had originally imagined it just kind of a bunch of curated officers yelling at everybody to get stuff done. And I was like, no, it's like, you know, these are professionals that need to repair a mech quick. They're not just yelling at each other. They're working hard to get the job done and collaborating. And so we're trying to kind of get more of that atmosphere in there. But yeah, the key thing that I've doing with gallery, and Blaine, you had mentioned this earlier, is a lot of the art has just gone to, you know, a cool looking mech shooting. And I miss a lot of the kind of early work where there was more atmosphere, like the mech was part of the scene. It wasn't the scene. And so that's, you know, what the commissions that we're doing through, you know, gallery, not necessarily commissions, it's more grants for artists and they can do what they want, but is to try and get out of that just mech centric, make it more mech background or technology background. And we got some cool ideas. You know, go ahead.
I was going to ask if I could ask a question, because I'm not sure when I'll get a chance to speak.
With everyone. we're still kind of, you know, in an interviewing each other format. And so, you know, as soon as we can get into just kind of like guard down, geeking out with each other.
Here's a question. I know everyone's going to be, they always ask this, what is your favorite mech? And everyone has the same answer. That's not the question. The question is, what is the classiest mech? If you were a classy gentleman and you needed to impress people with your dashing and daring do and panache and elan, what would your mech be? That's my question. And I will open this up with a Hauptmann. It has pointy ears and a jaunty cigar. And it's 95 tons of Lyran whoop ass. I mean, come on.
I'm going with the other end, and I think like an old, I love the Wasp. Actually, you can see it's the one blueprint I picked to put up on the, you know, I think it's just a cool looking mech that moves gracefully. It looks awesome. I think that's classy. It's not clunky, you know, it's kind of more in the kind of that.
I see the Wasp because of its sheer utility is kind of like the Honda Civic of mechs. And that's not an insult. That's not an insult, because seeing a Wasp in battle tank that's in good shape in the Succession Wars must be like going to the mall and seeing one of those Hondas that's been unmolested from the 90s. Like, it doesn't have the huge spoiler on it. Yeah. It doesn't have race seats in it. It's original paint. And you're like, and it's stupefying when you see it. You walk up to it, you're like, it's got the original rims on it. Holy shit. This is amazing.
So there you go. All right, Blaine, Mike, you know, if you had a mech to kind of cruise town, take for a jaunt, family mech, rich beyond imagination. We'll call it Star League era because I don't want to limit Tex's question, but nobody's going to be having their own private mech to jaunt around in, you know, in the Succession Wars.
I'd go with a Lancelot.
Okay. Lancelot?
Yeah.
Why?
That's the Black Knight. I don't want to seem like I'm being self-serving on the Black Knight side. So I'm going to go with Lancelot just for it. It's got cool lines to it. I think it's a cool mech.
Yeah, for some reason, the Centurion / Victor sort of humanoid mech, that aesthetic has always appealed to me. I think that's classy, strong, you know, looks good, functions in battle, but also, you know, if you've got two of them standing there beside the palace door, you know, they can look good that way too. So
nice. Yeah, Centurion has been my favorite since I read your books, Mike, back in the day, and saw Luce's art. Luce's battle Centurion over the MechWarrior Online one end of the week. Yeah. You know, so I'll certainly either make a commission of that myself or something in the future. Actually, when I was working with Jaden for the Archer project, I found out that he also does a lot of the paint schemes on the Unit Color Compendium. And most of them are my favorite ones that are just, no painter could ever paint them. They're just like absolutely gorgeous. There's one that's just like the entire thing is like, you know, Chinese characters and stuff. They're gorgeous. And so I was like, oh, you know, I want to do a commission for myself to kind of do a Renegade HBG paint scheme, you know, and have you just go with it, you know, with the colors. And so the Centurion is probably going to be, there's a short painter is somebody who did a lot of line art, maybe 6-7 years ago. And, he has a Centurion that looks a lot more kind of like the, you know, kind of like the Mechum, the Macross type of, you know, a Gundam than the more tank, you know, like where Battletech has gone. And so I definitely will see that'll be a future one for the channel, but,
Okay. Follow-up question.
Go for it.
You were a Solaris jock, because you know Solaris jocks are like when it comes down to customization of a mech.
Yep.
People think that Solaris jocks are like hot rod guys, and I think that's bullshit. I think, in all honesty, they're like those Japanese truckers that like customize out the truck with all the little lights, and they've got all the chrome, and they've got all the crazy stuff, and they wear the jacket that has a picture of their fucking truck on it. Yeah. When they leave their truck, you turn around and it's on their back. You know who they are. They're like, yeah. So if you were a Solaris jock, what would your mech be? And what would its paint job be?
You fight in your class, right? So you're not going to be outclassed in Solaris.
Unless you make it to the grand tournament where it's all classes, everything, you know. But even then, taking an assault mech is not an advantage when you're fighting shit that, you know, is real quick. So yeah, it's I'm gonna say for Solaris, I would do an awesome, just the barn door of doom. I would do an awesome with PPCs and maybe an SRM, maybe just additional armor. Okay. And I would go with that World War I razzle dazzle, or I would go with a Fabergé egg finish painted on it. So it was just people like, oh, that's really nice. And they won't shoot it. They'll hesitate for a minute. They'll think it's an art float. You know, I want them to hesitate because they see it and they realize they're destroying something beautiful. And then I kill them, you know, so that's my plan.
Destroying something beautiful is the theme of Battletech text.
It is. It's either that or paint a smaller mech on my mech. So when they put the reticle over it, they're like, wait, the distance is wrong. And, you know, just buy a little time. And before you think that's stupid, they did that in World War I on ships and it worked.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Razzle dazzle and all those other things. They found out that the Germans would measure a water line or a draft line. So they found out if you mispaint those on ships and they go by, they're like, oh, it's deeper than it is. They set the torpedo deeper and it just goes right under it. And then the crew's like, ha ha, fooled you with paint. No, it's Wile E. Coyote shit, but it works in real life.
Yeah. Paint. I don't know. I don't like come up with scratch, but I would just kind of go for imitation, and I would try to imitate that scheme I was just talking about.
Yeah, but that's cool though, because it's kind of like keeping an idea alive.
Yeah. Well, let me share it with you guys. This is the one I'm talking about that he did.
That's pretty. That's really pretty.
I would just trick out my mech like that.
No, it looks like a kimono, you know?
Yeah. I would drop the Hello Kitty, you know, but
hey, otherwise, no, yeah. that's part of its power, you know. It's part of its power.
Definitely.
You'll disrupt its chi.
Yeah, that's the direction I would go with my Solaris paint job. But yeah. And it would probably I think I'd go with the Centurion. I love the Centurion. For functionality, the Jenner, you know, in terms of, I just feel like the Jenner just packs a huge punch for what it is.
Oh, it does. The problem with the Jenner is you go from like mobile to like sneeze dead in like a second. And that's what terrifies me about the Jenner is the Jenner is like watching that guy at the bar who just slams four shots and starts hollering. And you know, the night's going to get interesting, but not in the way he plans. Right, so you keep an eye on that guy.
Well, you got if you're a pilot Jenner, you have to be a bully. You know, you only tick on things that are smaller. You know, and everything else you run away from.
No, Jenner,
which is dudes, light mechs in general.
Jenner dudes are those dudes that stare at you at the gym, waiting for you to get off the machine. They're that guy that's done like a rail of pre-workout. You know what I mean? Like they're just like, come on, bro, I gotta get my gains. Oh God. No, I think that Solaris Jacks would be amazing. You'd have stuff like dressed up like Macho Man, like down to the cowboy hat, sunglasses. You'd have you'd have corporate mechs, like it'd be like this murder brought to you by McDonald's, you know, and just have like the golden arches laying people out.
So this is one that I brought up in previous casts. This is for Blaine and Mike. I'm kind of fascinated about what goes on in the periphery. I'd love to see more stories kind of out in the periphery or out in the range, and, you know, sort of in the way that the BattleTech video game, what Jordan's been working on, where that explored. But is there, you know, have you guys considered that? You know, when you guys think about the periphery, kind of what do you imagine going out there? Or is there any jump ships that maybe snuck away with a bunch of colonists at one point that we don't know about, you know, anything along those lines that you guys have kind of dreamed up, but have never actually pulled the trigger, or gotten a green light for?
Yeah. You have to remember that for Jordan's project, I wrote essentially a novel, which was set out there, or four short novels that were set out there.
Really?
In the area that he was playing with. Yeah.
That's awesome. So, I didn't know that background.
Yeah. So I've been out there.
Yeah.
Actually, I think three of the four were there. The third one actually was on Solaris, for a variety of reasons. And that all took place before the Warrior books. So okay. it was, and before the Calhounds were formed.
Where are these novels? Are they published?
They were part of the Harebrained Schemes project.
Okay.
So if you would subscribe to it, at whatever level it was, you would have gotten those.
Okay. But they were files. They weren't printed. Is that,
I don't think they were printed. No.
Okay.
They were just PDFs. And then you have to remember that the Red Corsair, all the stuff that went on with Morgan and Arthur Louvon and Katrina with the Red Corsair, that was all peripheral stuff.
Yeah.
So there are stories that we thought of that just never got the green light. I mean, I did want to write that particular story, but that was when Rock had just taken over the line and we were discouraged. So instead I did natural selection, where you had someone else picking up the Red Corsair legend and playing with that stuff, going from there.
Right.
Yeah, because Rock did not want to move out of the continuity that had already been established. So,
yeah, that makes sense.
And I did Redemption and Malice for the Kickstarter, which was out in the periphery.
Okay.
The story I've always wanted to do, this will sound funny, we always focus on the battle backs, and I think that's important, but I always wanted, when I was doing Redemption and Malice, I started comparing the map of the Rim Worlds versus what we currently have in the Inner Sphere. And there are dozens of planets that are basically not on the map anymore. And it's hard to picture that the entire population was, you know, killed, left, or whatever. And I use one of those planets in the story Redemption and Malice to kind of tell an Old West story. You know, it's basically a Western set out there. But what I've always wanted to do is tell a story about a ship more than a mech. And it's the ship and the crew, and they've got a couple mechs, and they haul stuff sometimes. Sometimes they're called in as the local muscle. You know, kind of that Firefly kind of feel, but base it around like an old beat up, you know, drop ship that's making these runs to these backwater planets. And there's lots of them out there where things are going to be very different. And the law is very different. The rules are very different. And to me, I always thought that would be kind of a fun thing to do, but it's hard to do that when you've got all the big stuff going on and people are constantly trying to drive to, yeah, that's good, but tell us what's happening next in the Oakland era or whatever.
Right.
So it's hard to go back to some of that stuff and do kind of just pure standalone, but I always thought that would be fun. Cause to me, that's, if you think about Star Trek, you know, the ship is the character. BattleTech, we tend to make the mechs the character, but it'd be fun to kind of flip that paradigm a little bit. And it's a group living on a ship and eking out a living out in the periphery. And that could be fighting battles. It can be providing protection. It can be robbing occasionally. And I think that could be a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, I love that idea. One, you know, when they did the canon characters, I still haven't fleshed it out and finalized it, but the one, if I could have my way, it would be, you know, essentially a commander in something like the Explorer Corps, out there just finding new planets, kind of scouting the edge, you know, whatever challenges that they encounter along the way. You know, he can be, you know, a mech jock, you know, but that's not his primary job. You know, most of his job is kind of directing, you know, and captain of the ship or whatever it may be, and kind of what's happening on the fringe, you know, kind of what random settlements, you know, maybe you come across a, you know, like I was hinting at before, maybe a colony that kind of escaped notice and just kind of disappeared, you know, in the chaos of the First Succession Wars, and, you know, found a planet that was far enough off the grid that, you know, they've been there and had 300 years to get things sorted out and get things going. And you kind of just kind of what happens if the Explorer Corps kind of turns up on that, and maybe they realize that it's probably not a, maybe they shouldn't report that back to their bosses, and maybe they decide they're going to kind of settle down, join them or whatever it may be, but it'd be interesting.
And the book was called Far Country.
Oh, no.
Pretends it never.
Well, there's no decision to report back there, because you're definitely not reporting back. But have you guys, you know, I'm sure you have text, but Mike Blaine, have you seen George Lido's Far Country narration video?
No.
Oh, man.
No.
I'll send a link if you want a good laugh. It's an unexpected, you know, BattleTech end joke. It's a good one. Tex, have you heard that video?
I have.
Okay. The first time I caught that, I almost spit out my water.
Yeah. But, that's why I love working with George, is he's got like a tremendous sense of humor, but he's also a lot like many of those old voice actors like Mel Blanc, where you can just sit there and stare at stuff and then come up with a voice for it. So when we did a stream some time ago where he and I were sitting there looking at some of the old BattleTech art, which some of it was pretty wild, you know, where we've got like characters that look like just bikers or whatever. And there's George just putting on voices, which is hilarious. Like, yeah, just big, big 80s hair. Everyone's got the big sunglasses. Everyone's smoking and drinking and, you know, very just neon and edgy. And I got a mohawk and I have a gun. And yeah, everyone's just trying to outshadow run each other more or less. Yeah. And it's amazing to kind of work with people like that who just have this ability to make an absolute riot out of the universe, but still have appreciation.
Well, pulling you back to your work with BattleTech the game, you know, what was that like, kind of basically creating this pocket of the universe that was always there but never there, and then kind of fleshing that out? Because that had to have been, you know, an awesome experience.
Well, actually, I didn't do a lot of development with that.
Okay.
They were very good in saying, hi, you can play with these worlds. And so, you know, out of it, I pulled something that had a description that was close to something that I could write a story about, and then, you know, went ahead and did that. But it was a lot of fun working in that era, you know, around, 25 years before the Warrior books, you know, a good, 15, 16 years before the Calhounds were being formed, because I had done some fiction when they were starting out, and then able to kick it all the way back to essentially the year 3000, and still build on this whole continuity that I had going. I mean, there is stuff in the Harebrained Schemes stories that if you read them, suddenly connect back with the Calhound stories, connect back into the Warrior stories. And so that was a lot of fun being able to see as how far back I could extend, you know, my, the dagger I'd plunged into the universe.
Right.
And just see how deep that went. But that's always the, you know, when you're working in someone else's universe, you know, one of the things that you learn fairly early on, especially when it's a very well-established universe, the idea is pick some place that nobody is playing or where there's very little known about, and then own that place. Mm. You know, make it your own place, because there's very little to contradict you, and you basically know that everybody wants to know about that. And if it gets approved, suddenly you've established a hunk of canon that, you know, was never there before, and that kind of cements your position in that universe and gives you a lot of flexibility, you know, going forward from there.
Definitely. The kind of going back, maybe, you know, and reimagining, because you guys, Mike and Blaine, have spent the most time trying to problem solve how things actually work in the BattleTech universe, because you have to create it. What we touched on scale a little bit earlier of what it scale like. Do you think if scale was kind of properly reflected in BattleTech that you could actually have kind of planetary conquest? Do you think you can? Do you think if a planet has a population of hundreds of millions or billions that it's conquerable without destruction in the BattleTech universe?
One of the things you have to remember about the BattleTech universe, and Sam Lewis used to say this, is that we're doing science fiction combat with World War II technology.
Right.
So the ability to destroy the world per se, as long as nukes are taken off of the table, is somewhat mitigated.
Mm.
And then if we look at essentially mech combat as being very much stylized the way that samurai combat was, to minimize collateral damage, then what you really have are an unspoken parallel to the clans of bidding. You know, it's informal bidding. I send my troops, you defend with whatever you've got on the planet, and if I win, I win, and then I've got to defend, and you're going to send whatever you're going to send. So do I think it's possible for things to change hands without widespread destruction? Yes, provided one of your goals in conquest is to hold and preserve that world as an economic unit. And when you think about the great expense of interstellar conquest, if you can't hold it as an economic unit, if it's not going to contribute in some way, shape, or form, you really have to consider what you're doing in terms of actually devoting the resources to go after it.
Yeah, so that sounds like more like you know, maybe 18th century combat, and I'm kind of imagining more kind of modern or even kind of post-revolutionary war combat, with where there's guerrilla combat as an option. And it sounds like you're saying that it's pretty much been agreed upon that's not functional, that, you know, you have to have your lines of soldiers stand up and go against each other if you're going to be on the world.
You really don't want to start applying real world stuff to this.
Yeah. Well, this is what this is. This is where we can geek out and what if, you know.
I mean, you go H.G. Wells, you know, the comment when the Martians were attacking the Earth was, you know, humans are using bows and arrows against the lightning. You know, this is what your guerrillas would be facing. Gotcha. You know, sure. You know, they go out and they blow up a guard shack outside of our mech base. And then, you know, we have one mech land on them with both feet. There goes their tank, and burn everything else for a mile a mile or two in a circle. Okay. Guerrilla problem is pretty much handled.
Yeah.
And if you're not being mistreated by the people that have conquered you and they aren't really bothering you, your motivation to attack them is kind of gone.
Well, and if you take away, if you look at most of the modern wars, and you look at World War One was more of a political posturing, but you get to World War Two, it was all about raw material. Japan went to war because of the embargo that we placed on them, and you know, they needed the raw material, so they invaded China, they invaded Korea, they invaded Southeast Asia, etc., to secure the raw materials necessary to sustain an empire. Plants are big places. And I think this is why I always say, don't apply real world stuff to this. Once you do that, you start going, why would you conquer other than to establish yourself as supreme ruler? And it gets a little fuzzy because, let's face it, planets are huge. There's lots of resources on them. There's already, you know, ample population. So you start applying real world economics to some of this stuff, it becomes yeah, I might want to conquer a planet or two because of the resources that are there, etc. But, you know, you start losing that motivation beyond the fact of building a stellar empire. And that's always kind of a flimsy premise for doing stuff in modern logistics, etc. But, you know, that BattleTech is a space opera in some respect. And you got to kind of fudge those things a little bit so we don't get too caught up in exposing the real stuff to it.
Well, right. Well,
and the other economic thing you have is think of all the planets that never formed in all of those star systems. There's more than enough resources out there before you ever have to enter the big gravity wells.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a lot less expensive. So, you know,
we're oh, just yeah.
clean the rocks out of the sky.
Well, exactly. And I mean, there's more than enough stuff in the Oort cloud, the greater, I mean, God, just in the solar system. If you take the Oort cloud in, you could find more than enough rocks, water, and everything else that we would ever need for hundreds of years. And with the sun, yeah. if we made a Dyson sphere or a Dyson array or whatever else, you can live in a solar system forever.
Yeah.
As well, the other thing that you can't really apply is there is a certain period of integration when you take something over. It's one of those things that's very small. For example, you could take over another government and it may be another language. But it also may be all their trains are on different track. They keep time a different way. They count in base 8. You find all of these things that even though they are human, they're very different. And so there is a certain integration period where also taking over a government or a planet would be a pain in the ass because you would have an army pass through and then you would have to bring in this giant logistics staff to try to teach and indoctrinate these people into your way of running an empire. And you would have to make sure they accepted that on such a level that you wouldn't have to bring your army back. And so, yeah, that would be a pain in the ass. There are some things I can hand wave. When I stream, I'm routinely asked stuff in BattleTech where someone decides to play physics and goes, Tex, how could a battle mech be 20 tons? And I have two answers. I'll say like, oh, it's a Star League ton. Like we have long tons for shipping. We have deadweight tons for this. We have all these. A ton is a unit of measurement. So you could say, oh, it's a Star League ton. Or I could say, oh, that's how many tons of equipment after the engine that it can haul. You know what I mean? So you say, oh, as 20 tons of blah. Or you, whatever. It's not really important. But yeah. some people fixate on this. Some people are like, well, if an H bill costs this much and inflation is this much, how much does my rice candy cost? And I'm like, who gives a fuck? You know, it's one of those things like it's nice to know that the world has some touches, but there are some things you can just hand wave away or imagine and put your own spin on. Because I think the greatest parts of storytelling are in the margins. It's like you said in H.G. Wells, one of my favorite what ifs is if the Klan invasion came in, and they all get like the flu and die because despite all their genetics, they have not been exposed to 300 totally. Years of bad medicine and crowded conditions and bombarded planets, which would breed a horrible host of viruses. So, you know, they conquer some world that's been conquered 80 times on the Draconis border and they go into the slums and get sneezed on. And he's like, brother, I feel ill.
That could work both ways, though. The clans had their own illnesses and diseases they were exposed to. So,
are you kidding me? Clanners probably have germs the size of turtles they have to box. I will not be sick this day.
This is one of the things that when you're writing fiction in the universe, you have to make allowances for. One of the things that I figured out really early on is that when you look at the ranges, they're unrealistic if you actually use the numbers.
Sure, which is sure, absolutely.
In every combat I've got, it'll be at long range or medium range or short range or point blank range, but there's never any value attached to that. So you just have to, you know, every reader will imagine what they see that distance to be.
Well, right, because if an LRM reaches like 1,000 meters, that would be the saddest General Dynamics product in history. I mean, if I'm buying a weapon system, I don't want to have to look them in the eye, damn it. I just want to know they're gone.
Well, look, this also precludes the readers who will sit there and do the math. I remember one novel FASA sent me in manuscript, and one of the authors was describing a missile launched and hitting hitting a spaceship. And he described the weight of the missile, the speed of the missile, and all of the little physics details we needed. And he described it in hitting the ship's armor and bouncing off. And I, because he had given me the hard numbers, and because I'm a pain in the ass, I did the math and figured out that basically that weight, that mass traveling at that speed would have cracked our moon in half. There is no way a starship is going to have armor that will allow that to bounce off.
But little do you know about moontanium.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And but, my point was, look, just eliminate these numbers.
Right. Okay? No, I agree with you. I mean,
it's going really, really fast. But the armor was better. That's all you have to do to maintain this fiction. And that's what our job is, for Blaine and me to make sure that we don't put anything in there that knocks you out of the experience, that causes you to, we want you to suspend disbelief, and we don't want to knock you into that thing where you're going, huh, wait a minute, that isn't how it works.
I'm with you. I had a guy who asked me via email, and I noticed his email was a school email for a notable physics school. And he was asking because he said that he was looking at fusion engines. And he said that he is a physics student. And he asked, what do the fusion engines run on? Is this a deuterium? Is this blah, blah, blah? And I said, I really don't exactly know the special blend of herbs and spices they run on. And he made this incredible observation. He says, well, if you use dry lithium hydride, you wouldn't actually have to worry about water storage or anything else. And it's inert and it can be stored as like a powder, and it would be like storing dust. And I'm like, that's incredible. Write catalyst, please. but yeah, it's fun to kind of get in your head, like that email I received, where you start wondering how these things work, or what would it be like to drive one? What is it like driving a mech when it's running hot? It's very easy in a game to ignore a heat gauge. It's very difficult in real life to ignore it's 90 degrees, sure. Where you're just like, fuck.
Well, the this one, maybe Tex, you can team up with me. This can be Tex and the podcasters versus the authors for questions. So there's two things I'd like you guys to kind of flesh out in terms of how they actually work in the BattleTech universe. And this is not fantasy, but the neural helmets have gone through such a range of kind of what they look like, what they are, rule of cool usually for the art and what it is. Listen, can you guys take us through exactly what is the recent interpretation of what the neural helmet is, what it looks like?
I'll be right
like.
Back. I'll show you.
Excellent. Excellent. Listen, let me tell you, the best neural helmet
I'm a little scared right now.
No, don't worry about it. The best neural helmet is that giant bucket with the face flap. That's my favorite neural helmet. We have neural helmet at home with a like diving helmet. That's the one I like.
Oh boy.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yeah. All right.
Oh, let's get audio back.
Sorry, had to do that, but
is that nice. It? That's
yeah,
the official?
That's mine.
Okay. That's yours. Okay.
That's Kerensky's from when he kicked down the gate.
All right. Nice.
Cool.
So, and coolant vests, neural helmets, you've guys written them a lot. Has that evolved? What is the kind of the current interpretation? Was it, because I know, I don't know if you guys, Blaine, you probably did. I don't know, Mike, if you did, if you caught the MechWarrior Bulldogs that Bruins, the short animatic that he put out a couple months ago. But there were all people, kind of clamoring because at the end, in a show of victory, the Locust pilot took off her Nero helmet. while she was sprinting, you know, and it's like that, that mech would have face planted immediately. And the other, you know, group is like, well, the, you know, sprinting in a straight line doesn't require the balance of the pilot. So, you know, can you guys, you know, answer that kind of geeky question? Like exactly what is the, where do you, where does the need for a neural helmet begin and stop, and exactly kind of what its function is? And if it's not in your purview, if that's, you know, a question for, you know, for Lauren Moore and his staff, then you can punt that one if you want.
You want to tackle it, Mike?
Well, I mean, to your first question of have things evolved? Absolutely. In literally in the Warrior books, especially on Solaris, you know, we were using the traditional bucket, the flak vest, cooling vest kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in Assumption of Risk, when Kay is driving Yinla Wang and sort of following up on his father's legacy, it's a much more stylish, more slender, so the coolant is probably better, smaller helmet, so that just in those 30 years, the technology had produced a better setup. I mean, one of the things with technology is you can always get it cheaper, smaller, and it does more. You know, that's just how technology develops. And so that was how I envisioned that going. So to me, yes, they do evolve. In terms of when do you need it or when do you don't, I've always sort of figured it's kind of like a seatbelt. It's the first thing that goes on and the last thing that comes off. And presumably, you know, the mech is not moving when you decide to take it off. But that's always just been my assumption.
Yeah, I've kind of operated the same way, honestly. It's, you have to have it in order to successfully pilot the mech, because it's using your neurofeedback to feed the gyro, to maintain balance, and it's your own personal sense of balance that kind of keeps that mech upright. And if you disconnect that, that's bad. That's really bad. But when we started, I remember the artwork that we were given for the neuro helmet, and it was like, you got to be kidding me. It was a tiny little window and a giant.
That's bucket. My favorite one. I love it.
And it was like, gee, if I turn my head, I can't see anything. And, but you know, that's 3025 era. So, you know, that was back when, you know, we were defending a planet with a lance of mechs and scavenging.
That's when entropy ruled the universe.
Right.
Everything was collapsing. And
right.
And you know, with 3025 and the with the starting with the Warrior books, one of the things that Jordan and I discussed was the fact that if you're going to have the universe expand and keep going, entropy is going to have to be reversed at some point or mitigated at the very least. And so that's why, you know, there was the NIS and there were all the different things that were trying to push technology forward so that we could have new things. Because again, you know, in terms of the meta picture, the game was going to have new stuff to sell new product. Mm-hmm. So this is why we were going to, you know, develop this stuff. And then they started working on the battle pods, and suddenly we had the clans begin to roll in, and that was another quantum leap on the technology going forward.
And kind of on a similar strain, how do you guys imagine the coolant vest? Do you, there's old artwork, you know, I think on like Sorensen Sables, it's just a vest and they're mostly, you know, in their underwear. Other than that, you know, do you imagine it more like a flight suit, you know, like a naval aviator, you know, covers the whole body and insulates the whole body, is it truly a vest and the rest of the body is kind of open?
In Assumption of Risk with Kay, it was more of a full body suit, just running all over the place. And again, it was better coolant. So you were getting, you know, not as much chemicals running around, but more efficiency in terms of drawing the heat away.
Gotcha.
I've done it both ways, depending on the warrior, you know, so I think some guys are going to go in wearing togs, you know, just shorts and have a vest, and some are going to go with a full suit. To me, it's a matter of what your preference is and what's available to you. And, you know, to me, I don't see it as a major stumbling point. You know, it's extra weight. That's for sure. You know,
Well, I ask in part because I'm trying to get, you know, art commissioned, and I'd love to kind of know, kind of, is there an official consensus on what kind of the, what the pilots are wearing? And my next question would be like, what's the cockpit look like? Are there pedals? Are there, you know, how much of it is controlled by the helmet? You know, are there joysticks? You know, so, you know, Mike, I know you're about to say something, but like next question, you know, what's a cockpit of a mech look like? What are the controls? Sure. I mean,
just real quick, back to Blaine's point, mm-hmm. you know, what resources are available to the pilot also include what resources can the pilot afford?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the micro and macroeconomics of all of that stuff, when you're maintaining your own machine, you know, repairs, equipment, replacement equipment, that sort of stuff is going to be expensive. And so you'll want to pay attention to that. For me, the cockpits, I describe the cockpits in a fair amount of detail. I mean, there are joysticks, there are monitors all over the place. Sure, I suspect some mechs have got pedals that may operate as throttles of some sort. Others may not. You know, just depend upon what the control situation is. But a lot of those early description of cockpits came out of both illustrations, and then when they were playtesting the battle mech cockpits, they were doing that, you know, at FASA. And so, you know, you'd be there for a summit and you'd get taken over and get to sit in these cockpits and, you know, and try this stuff out. And it was like, wow, you know, yeah. And the final production ones didn't have as much in the way of cool stuff you could do in the pre-production models. But, you know, in terms of closing you into this tiny closet where all you're seeing are, you know, the feeds from these monitors and stuff, really gave it the sort of claustrophobic sense you would have inside a Mac. And that made for a real fun experience, which then translated into how these things got described going forward.
Yeah, a lot of it for me, if you look at the very first edition of Mech Warrior, the role-playing game, that wonderful cockpit shot, you know, and you see it even now with MechWarrior Destiny, they recreated it with modern artwork. There's lots of buttons and gauges and stuff. And to Mike's point, I keep a copy of the old handbook for the mech pods around. And if I have to go back to kind of referencing how a cockpit looks, I go back to that. Mm-hmm. And at Gen Con, I always play in the mech pods. If you play MechWarrior Online, it's the same thing. You know, the layouts are a little bit different every mech that you're getting into, but there's a gyro, there's a fusion reactor control, there's all this other stuff that you would be looking at if you were a pilot. You know, when you're playing the game, you're more or less just running and shooting, but, you know, there's a lot of cool controls.
And are you imagining the joysticks are just, you know, independently operating the aiming the weapons, shooting the weapons, or are there other functions to the joysticks? Because we talked about, you know, is there two joysticks? Is there a throttle and a joystick? You know,
there's two joysticks, and mostly I've described two joysticks. Yeah. In the books, I've described the ability to split the targeting.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be operating left side, right side independently. And so good pilots could actually go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
You know, but again, you know, the inside cockpit design is going to depend upon who's going.
On the mech.
Yeah.
Cool.
And don't ask me how the hands work, because I've never been able to figure that out. That's why when Mike says two joysticks, if I'm doing something where I'm using hands, I will reference two joysticks, one right, one left.
Yeah.
Because there's an assumption that somehow there's finger controls on there that allow you to manipulate the hand on the mech, etc. We've never figured that out. That's all magic. It's kind of like how ammunition flows through a mech. It's best if we just don't go there.
I'd imagine that's controlled more by the gyro. And if anything, you know, there can be a separate glove that you can take your hand off the joystick, because you're not going to be, you know, necessarily shooting while you're picking stuff up with your hand.
Yeah, but we've never shown that or described it. But it's that's always a tricky one.
Mm-hmm.
Mike did a great job with that. I had to dig it out recently because I was doing an Elemental story. I was going through some of Mike's stuff on how the elemental controls work with the eyes and the jaw and all that. And it was absolutely fantastic stuff because it never, it's like he covered it in fiction once and I've never seen it ever touched on again. So I had to go back to it, reference
what,
it.
What novel? I remember reading that. What novel was it though? Do you remember?
Got to be Lethal Heritage.
Yeah, I think it was Lethal Heritage that was going through it. But I mean, Mike really thought through how all the visuals of how they could dot their eyes and click their tongue a certain way or whatever would control certain aspects of the suit. And, you know, we don't spend a lot of time on some of that stuff, but it was great going back to it because I could leverage it. It's established canon and it was a lot of fun to go back to.
Yeah. That's one of the pieces that I definitely aim to commission through the gallery is elemental focused on the suits and the functionality of the suit. So it either, you know, it'd probably be the an elemental probably either getting the armor off after combat or on before combat. You know, I think after would be a little bit cooler just because you can see some damage in the exhaustion in the mech warrior. But I don't know if you guys, how much you guys play video games, but at the end of like Halo 4 and Master Chief finally gets his armor off, you know, it's not saying it's the same, but just that idea of kind of finally seeing how that armor is removed because, you know, it's not a visual that we've been exposed to before. My next question, text chime in if there's something that you'd want fleshed out kind of conceptually, but
I have a lot of headcanon on stuff. Like when I think of like cooling suits, when I was thinking of how things worked in the 3025 era or even the periphery at any point, I envision kind of World War One era ish diving suits, you know, and as far as cooling stuff, I envision somewhat like the Soviet Tu-22 bomber, which is an alcohol heat exchanger. Which, believe it or not, the alcohol transported on board that heat exchanger becoming somewhat of a commodity that is sold by the mech warrior or the pilot of the Soviet aircraft. So I could imagine like the ground crew, he gets back and they have the alcohol left over from heating and cycling. And they're like, yes, let's have a toast, you know, or something horrible because, you know, guys who work maintenance are crazy. And so, and I say this having friends who work maintenance in the Air Force. They're all nuts. So the thing is that I like the idea of drawing a lot of parallels to the modern world, at least with how things work, because why invent a super chemical that's cryogenically frozen and blah, 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 when it's like, hey, this is how a heat exchanger works and any chemical works as long as it's not terribly toxic.
Right. So then my next kind of question to flesh out is how do you envision mechs moving? You know, and so BattleTech draws its origins from Macross and Dugrum, you know, where mechs are very mobile, agile, and we've kind of seen this settle into like a very cumbersome mech-like motion, which I'm definitely not a fan of. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Bruins's work, and I think he kind of nails mech movement. But I'm curious, kind of how you guys kind of envision, like exactly how mobile are they, how tanky are they, you know, kind of in your imagination when you're writing. And where on that spectrum between a giant walking tank, you know, and you know, say the Dugrum from the original Dugrum series, you know, where do you see kind of the movement of the mech working in BattleTech, and how much can be done?
I mean, I guess for me, I've always seen the lighter ones are going to be more agile, mm-hmm. More fluid, faster. The bigger ones, you know, are going to move more ponderously. You're just trying to get a lot of, you know, a lot of mass movement. And so that's how I've always, seen it, I guess. Blaine?
I don't know, somewhere in between walking tank. I don't ever get the vibe of a walking tank. Cause we do a lot of juking around and moving and stuff. We were talking at one summit, or the last one, we were talking about mech movement and some of the earlier novels that came out in the Dark Ages, and they were having mechs do things like a somersault and things along those lines. And Randall's the ultimate person to crunch this. And Randall was like, I could make the math work to make a mech do a somersault. And he goes, But the question is, why would you ever do that? You know, and you know, he's like, the amount of damage it would do, the amount of disruption it would do to the pilot, and where it would leave you at the end of that somersault, it would always kind of position you there. And when Randall said that, it told me, you know, I think there's a little more fluidity of movement than just them running, you know, kind of box like with their legs and turning and shooting. It's not like it's not an M1 Abrams tank. There's a little bit more of a nuance to it.
I agree that it can't be 100% tank, even though an M1 Abrams tank is graceful in its way. It's where the suspension's adjusting and the guns, you know, automatically training and stabilizing and all that. That's really cool. But it's one of those things where if you look at really, really tall buildings and you go to the base of them, you'll notice they have like all these shock absorbers and all of this other stuff built in, because as it turns out, really big things don't like moving a lot without breaking. So when you look at big machines and how they move, like steam engines and everything else, they have their own sort of balance and sway to them that can be graceful, depending on how they're designed. But I think that there has to be some sort of balance or humanness to the movement in order to just not do a shitload of damage with every step. Because if you have something that's really rigid and stomping, all the impacts are going to be hard. And if you doubt it, you know, go stomp and walk robotically a mile and see how you feel. You know, it's not a natural way of movement.
Yeah.
And so I think part of the way a mech moves would be also somewhat dependent on the pilot. I think you would be able to recognize a pilot for how their mech walks. Oh, totally. Like it has a slight, you know, way of walking in a certain way that's reminiscent in the way the pilot walks and smokes a cigarette. You know, it's a sort of shuffle of the feet or a certain bounce to the step, mm-hmm. where you could tell who was actually in the machine, which again would be a cool story element to see. Like, oh yeah, that's his trademark, you know, little hop way of walking as he does that in formation when he's late. You know what I mean? So you could see how someone was by their interface with the machine.
Yeah, I like that.
De facto, the machines have got to move in a more organic fashion than just a mechanical fashion. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been made to be representations of organic life.
Yeah. Oh, of course, you know, of course. You know, I mean, yeah, why wouldn't they make just a giant tank or something?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's like verbatim how I answered a question like that on a comment the other day. I come from a, you know, athletic background and coaching, and it's funny, Tex, that you mentioned kind of the style, but because when I've coached an athlete long enough, I coach rowing, and so we're out in boats on the river. If I coach an athlete long enough, actually it doesn't take too long, maybe, you know, two seasons or so. If it's dusk, you know, and I can just see a shadow of an athlete a quarter mile away, I can tell what athlete is rowing just by kind of just the subtlety of their motions, you know. So, and yeah, I like that idea of kind of being able to see that in battle mix as well. And then similar to kind of taking that athletic background again, I always kind of did it on a scale of athletes in terms of the mechs, where, you know, I see kind of the light mechs being like an Olympic sprinter, you know, the assault mechs being kind of more like, you know, maybe a sumo wrestler, maybe it's kind of like Andre the Giant, you know, like a very large kind of, but still relatively agile, you know. And then kind of the in-betweens kind of being more like kind of an NFL running back, maybe for a medium mech, you know, and maybe something in between, maybe like a power lifter for, you know, heavy mechs. And just terms of there's athleticism there, there's mobility there, but there's definitely a difference, a weight to the motion and kind of range of motion. Yeah,
I think the only challenge you have is if we compare some of the old artwork, it's hard to picture some of those joints moving
mm-hmm.
more.
Well,
some of them, yeah. You can't. I'll be honest with you. There's two mechs I've looked at over the years that I'm like, I can't figure out how they walk. Yeah. The way the leg configuration is and the center of gravity, it's like that's a leg and it looks right, but I don't know if it could actually propel a mech forward.
Well, yeah, but it's one of those things where people can look at mechs and they can say, oh, they'd never build that. And then I can go open a history book and say, hey, look, it's the P-51 that they made two of and they welded it together and you got two P-51s for the price of four. And, well, you know, you do stuff like that. And you would go, they didn't make, yes, they did.
Building it and bring it to market are two different things, right? We build all kinds of good stuff. But, you know, to what Blaine said, it's funny you said, because the hips were a focal point of that Archer design when I was talking with Jaden for the Gallery 30. It's my five piece was, you know, we always like very much like, I want kind of that Archer style or that Macro style Spartan ball hip joint. Because I want to know the legs can move laterally and pivot and turn. And all the Mech Warrior Online stuff is just like two rectangles attached from a piston. You know, I'm like, how does that thing pivot? How does it turn? The second you have a force coming from the side, that thing's going to fall over. Hips in the art is a big one for me. It's important to get that one right. Now, Mike, you know, where's your connection to BattleTech? You know, you've got so much, you know, other stuff. And even Blaine, I was listening to your podcast with the guys on, I think, Wolfnet. You were talking about the production of the Black Knight, which was fascinating to kind of get behind the scenes and how much goes on to that. And everyone that complains about Kickstarter, I recommend you listen to that, so you actually know what happens when you're producing something to market. But, you know, Mike, I'm curious kind of how you still stay in contact with BattleTech. Are you still playing a lot? You know, do you play the video game? You know, are you just playing tabletop with friends? You know, what is that connection like these days?
You know, mostly it's I get a call from Seattle and they say, we need you to do this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah.
I don't really game as much as I ought to. I know I had talked to Jordan about getting me a copy of the online game. And we just haven't connected to do that. I don't know if you guys heard, there was a disease last year. It was in the papers and, you know, kind of curtailed meeting a lot of people and seeing stuff. But that's it. You know, because my connection has always been, even from the very beginning, a professional one. You know, my ability to enjoy BattleTech as a game has never been clean, if you will.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you work for a game company, and this is true across the board, you work for a game company, and you go to play a game produced by that company, everyone assumes that you're an ace at it.
Yeah.
So they do one of two things. They stay away from you on the board because they don't want to die.
Yeah.
Or everybody gangs up on you and kills you immediately.
Yeah.
And both of those are really not very much fun. So pretty much the only time I get to play BattleTech now are at the Masters and Minions games at Gen Con, where the Catalyst staff pairs up and then faces off against fans who've come to play.
Yep.
And we play in a big tournament and mechs get destroyed and people get to take them home with them and that's just a lot of fun.
Well, we've both been in contact with Oliver over in Germany. That's 1 in 5-1 on Twitter. And actually your mechs just went on the mail today and they look beautiful. Okay, that he painted for you. So
the pictures were gorgeous. Absolutely.
They look better in person. He, you know, I traded him a bunch of box sets, you know, that he wasn't able to get in Germany and got like, I think I got, you know, 15 or more mechs painted. They look absolutely incredible. You'll enjoy those when you get there. So
yeah, they'll end up in the gallery. So.
Excellent. Yeah. I saw the Mara Jade oversized card out there. That's I need to pick up that card for my Star Wars CCG, which I just picked back up in the last couple months. I was like, man, I've had these cards for 20 years in a box. I need to kind of get into it. And you must be excited, not to kind of veer too far off BattleTech, but with Rogue Squadron being converted into a movie, that's quite a privilege. That must be fun to see happening.
It really is. It's you know, the announcement got made last November, and you know, I, like everybody else, I'm eager to see what is going to come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that's come out of it so far is that in September, Rogue Squadron is being re-released by Bantam or Del Rey as one of their prestige, the Essential Legends series.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll come out in a trade paperback. And for a book that's been out for 25 years, to 25 years later, have it upgraded into a trade paperback is really something very cool. And, but in terms of the movie, Patty Jenkins has been really nice in crediting the X-Wing novels, you know, and just saying that she wants to use the X-Wing novels essentially as the foundation for mm-hmm. what she's going to be building on to do the next generation of Rogue Squadron. So I'm really excited about all of that. And I know she's been doing her homework and yeah. You know, flying around in F-15s and doing all that's the awesome. Fun research. Yeah. So I envy her that.
Yeah.
Because when I was doing the novels, never quite got to do that. Right. I did get to go to a grocery store and put a quarter in one of those little things. Out
and go back and forth.
That was some pretty good research. But but she's getting to actually fly in the real plane. So
that's awesome. Well, I'm excited to see it. Yeah. You know, Tex, kind of pull back to you. I threw out the Nero helmets and stuff and the mech movement. Were there any kind of things that you have to have a question that you want to flesh out?
God,
and I'm sure you've probably read more BattleTech than any of us because you do it history.
I dabble.
Okay.
I am a monkey with a typewriter who has found an audience.
In our podcast, you told me how many hours you spend researching material for each of those episodes.
It's,
so
it's absurd. it
did
is.
You do, did you do a retrospective on the Battle for Tukiad?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I remember listening to that and being quite entertained. So
yeah.
Well, thank you, sir. I hate clanners, and I let them know it.
And that was somewhat apparent.
Well, you're not supposed to like them, and it's okay to like say I hate the Empire in Star Wars, like God, fucking Empire. You know, that's the point. They're the bad guys. You know, the best part about the Inner Sphere, though, is you're not everyone there is the good guys either. So it's like a desperado walking into a salty bar. And he's like, reach for the sky, and everyone turns around with two guns. It's just like, who's this guy? Oh, he's new.
Yeah, I love the Tukiad one. The Trippets one was probably my favorite, I would say, you know, just because it was obscure and it hit on that kind of peripheral mystery that I already said. But if Mike, if you haven't caught that one, the Trippets Affair episode is awesome.
Thank you. I'm humbled by that because again, I see myself as like a schmuck. I've gotten to become canon by accident, and people are now trying to look up the little world I invented in the periphery, which doesn't exist. It's not a real place. It's just something I invented to try my hand at writing in BattleTech, but I wanted to create something that's so utterly insignificant. That's why it's not on the map. It's like any town that the highway bypass, you know, went far away from. It's like any town in Kansas where you go 20 miles off the interstate. And it's got that same diner that's serving that same slice of pie. And they'd sure love it if you'd stay the night and they're in that surely no murders happen, you know? And I love that BattleTech still allows you to kind of indulge that same way. And many systems do that very well. Like Traveler, the role-playing game system, does that very well, where you can create your own beautiful little slice of the universe. And no one can take that away from you, because in BattleTech, you can create these amazing merc units that just fit in the world. And as long as you're not trying to make them like, I'm Kill Fuck Soul Shitter, the Annihilator of Babies. As long as you don't make some guy that's like the biggest, strongest Warhammer 40K style character. As long as you make some guy that's like, yeah, I'm a D-minus merc unit and I fight in the Chaos March. That's valid. And you can do that all day. You can make Pirate Kings all day. You can play yet another just random battle mech unit of the Lyran Guards, and you can create your own little piece of the universe and play it. And there's not a lot of games that allow you to do that like BattleTech does. And that's one thing that I'm very thankful for. And I think many of the people out there who enjoy BattleTech are thankful for, because if there's something that needs fleshing out, it arrives at great discussion and everyone has their own ideas and everyone pours into it. And it's beautiful and fun because it's collaborative, instead of other fandoms where you like go into Star Trek and it's like, well, how does this work? Well, let me get you this guide. And it's like 80,000 cited pages of how a transporter works. And don't even get me started on Wikipedia.
The, well, I think You know, I think it's easy to underestimate, you know, kind of the roles that we have. And I think certainly beyond just the charity thing, I think the difficulty for me, it's amazing how much BattleTech I'm not familiar with, because I'm really not familiar with much beyond 3055, you know, not for lack of desire, more for lack of time and bandwidth, you know. And Mike, as you say, like, you know, you are involved as a developer, creator, you know, there. And Blaine, I remember you making a post that, you know, you took advantage of retirement to dive into the BattleTech game. But if, you know, had it been for retirement, you probably wouldn't have been, you know, doing those things. And so, you know, I think that Text, what you do is you give people a vector to get involved, an entertainment factor. And that's another thing. It's funny. I, you know, I'm top of my field in terms of coaching athletics, and I have a channel where I talk in depth about training methodology in a way that, you know, just there's not out there, because a lot of stuff is just cookie cutter, 5-10 minute videos, this, do this. And I'm more like, let's talk for 30 minutes about this energy zone and why you train it and how you train it. That channel after has been around for twice as long. It's got 1200 subscribers, you know, it's immensely valuable. And my fun channel for BattleTech, you know, kicking up close to 7,400 now. And I think that it's easy to undervalue how much more people value the introduction of levity into their lives and enjoyment and entertainment, you know. And I think that, you know, your episodes are a great way to do that, in the same way that, you know, Blaine and Mike's, you know, novels are a way to kind of immerse them in the universe, you know, where they can pick up and put down a novel, but you can't just hop into, you know, a 5-hour tabletop game and, you know, get an hour in and be like, all right, well, let's take a break, you know, let's come back to this in 2 days, you know. And so, you know, that variety of vectors, and I think how each of us kind of, you know, tackle that and give people a way to live it and that fits in with their lives is important. So
I tend to agree. I was out this last weekend and we drove by Golden Corral and I just started chuckling. And my wife was like, "What's so funny?" I said, "I have to explain to you Space Golden Corral."
Yeah. In the Shoney's Nebula.
Yeah. And I had to, you know, I said, let me find you the picture of Amaris and you know, why this is important, you know, and that artwork of him standing next to the dumpster behind Space Golden Corral. And she thought it was goofy, but my grandson was in the car and he was totally into it. You know, he's like, from now on, it's just Space Golden Corral.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And I love being able to do that, because it's like, you know, one, you don't go to Golden Corral to make good memories. Like, no good story started. So there we were at Golden Corral, celebrating a long and prosperous business arrangement. You know, it's usually like Uncle Murray died. The good restaurants were closed. There was a snowstorm. We all walked into Golden Corral and got kicked out, you know. And it's so Golden Corral for me in my childhood, because my family is a huge redneck amalgamation that's just shotgun blasted across Texas and Oklahoma. It's like Golden Corral and stuff like that, I think, will endure in the BattleTech universe, because there will always be a need for warm matter around which you can congregate. I mean, food and memory, right?
Definitely. And hopefully this podcast has been that for people to congregate, but you know, we're coming up on 2 hours. I don't want you guys turning into pumpkins, and I really appreciate it. You know, hopefully you didn't run afoul of too many NDAs, you know, with these two of our questions. Texas face is an NDA, so, you know, we had that at least, but we
covered
that.
I don't exist, probably.
But yeah, I just want to say thank you, you know, for, you know, Mike, you just finished a big project. I don't know if you can announce it, but I know it's kind of, you know, or even what genre it is, but Mike just finished a, you know, new project. I assume it's a book.
Yeah. I've got a Gears of War novel coming out.
In awesome. Yeah. Wonderful.
Congratulations.
So yeah. Was that, I remember you mentioning that, I think in our last episode, that you were going to dive into that. Is what universes have you been writing the most in lately?
So the Gears of War is one. I did a novel set in the Dark Souls universe. So those are the two main ones, and then I've been doing BattleTech stories for Catalyst all the way along. So those have been the universes that I've mostly been writing in, and I've been doing development on development and writing on some of my own projects, a sequel to Tally and Revenant, as well as a whole bunch of stories in a superhero universe that that I created about 10 years ago and have great fun writing in. So
awesome. And then Tex, you said you're working on the Warhammer next and then the Charger. That's what's coming up for you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on my third draft of the Warhammer and my brain just keeps going to really dumb places where I'm sitting there thinking like, my brain's like, all right, we're going to do a really good episode and I'm going to try to keep this one under an hour. And then my brain goes, hey, it's called the Warhammer. And I'm like, yes, brain, I know. And it goes, hey, yeah, there was that guy named John Michael Thor who did a song called Warhammer. And it's metal. And you should probably, and I'm like, no, brain, come on. And then I start talking to my roommate, Goat, who's the Brazilian-American songwriter I work with to write a lot of the Battletech retardation, crazy, weird, wacky stuff I make. And he goes, Warhammer, huh? And I'm, yeah. And he goes, John Michael Thor. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, we could do that. And I'm like, oh, no. So then that's just how these things stumbles. I get these really funny ideas, but then it goes to like Mike. And Mike is this magical entity which lives in his own little realm. And through his magical pixel abuse and by hitting key codes into his computer, he can make fantastical, crazy things happen that are not real, but are made real through movie magic, or as he calls it, editing. And it's amazing to create these shit posts and or art. Or I was contacted, Christ, by a doctorate who said that they assumed I worked in academia because that these are doctorate level theses on transmedial studies or something, like telling stories through other medium than just writing them down, like oral history or what have you.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck, I didn't know that. Like, I thought I was just trying to make people laugh and show people why I love my universe. And now I'm getting people, like, I'm sitting down with fucking Blaine Pardoe and Michael Stackpole, and I'm just another schmuck on the wall. And so one of the things I want to say is, if you love a universe, it can love you back. And that's one of the rare things I feel about Battletech. Like, I don't play 40K anymore. They don't miss me. You know what I mean? They don't miss me at all. But if I stopped talking about Battletech or what have you, I would feel missed because I've met all of these amazing people and I've been touched by what they've shared with me. So while I am just building more silly videos, I look forward to the people I meet and the people I help introduce into something that helped me so much as a child.
Definitely. Yeah. The people underestimate kind of just the little comments and the nice things in the stories, you know, in the videos. I love, you know, the cartoon, the remastered cartoons are still get the most views on my channel. And just hearing people say, well, my 10-year-old will finally watch this, you know, because it actually looks great now. And it's not just, you know, a snowy, you know, colored snow. And so that's, you know, it's great to hear, but yeah, so thanks to all those people that take the time to kind of follow up. But and Blaine, you're still writing Hour of the Wolf, I think, was your last Battletech novel.
I've got my first political thriller released yesterday, Blue Dawn.
Excellent.
Which has been fun. And I finished a Battletech novel rewrite because they had me move the planet it was on, which changed a few hundred things. And that's called No Substitute for Victory. And it's in the Oakland era, which is a lot of fun. It's Jade Falcon novel. And it's just a different book for the clans and a different piece. And I've got a bunch of Battletech stuff coming out that tied to the Kickstarter, as well as some other stuff that has been written. So a bunch of Snords of Regulars material.
Oh, nice.
Stuff like that. So there's going to be some real fun stuff coming.
Very cool. And he used my character in the intro, so I'm biased.
Yeah, twice, actually.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I'm looking forward to it. You know, everyone, I'll put links to everybody's kind of sites and social media so you can follow these wonderful creators, you know, by clicking on those links. And thanks for listening. And thanks again, guys, for joining me. This has been fun. And for everyone listening, we'll catch you on the next episode. Bye.
See you later.